Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 643. I'm one of your hosts, Skyler Vicroy. And of course, joining me as ever is Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going, dude?
It's good. I'm a little tired from working all day today. Bad day at work. But it's going to be a great day because we're going to talk about motorcycles. And I want to assure everyone, I swear, cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye, I stopped reading for Chaos. But Chaos continued this weekend at the Styrian Grand Prix. It's not my fault, people.
No, I think it's just a hex on this season. Now, I feel you about the work stuff. I've been pulling extra hours and doing side projects, and I've got enough projects at home, and I keep adding new stuff. I was telling you before, I've been trying to build a new PC and set up a new work-from-home station. It's been busy. That's why we've been a little late getting the show out this week, because there's just been house projects at the other house I used to live at that need to get done because there's an appraiser coming. And I tell you, Jim, but you know what? After all that hard work, at the end of the day, you just got to go ahead and crack open a cold one and enjoy some motorcycle racing.
And that's how it rolls, man. What you got this time, my friend?
So today, so we all know I've been on my Almanac Brewing kick, and they released another new beer. I mean, they're just crushing it this summer. They have gone up my scale. They haven't beat out Dust Bowl, who sits at number one, but they did slide into number two, which was that's pretty good for a brewery that I just discovered this year. This one is their Unfiltered Opinion IPA, which I figured was perfect for me and this show because I have quite a few of those from time to time after having some brews. So it's another hazy IPA, still on my hazy kick, but a great beer. It matches my personality for this show for sure.
Excellent. Sounds good. I want to find me a beer and have one during one of these shows. There's a Great Lakes Brewing Company here, and they're coming out with a new IPA. So I might have to go pick myself up one of those and enjoy one with you during the show.
Oh, I fully encourage it. We'll see how it goes. All right, folks. Well, you know, it's another back-to-back, run-it-back kind of show. We were headed back to Austria, so that's what we're going to be covering in the Styrian Grand Prix. But before we get there, there is some news and some important news that was announced this week. And, Jim, why don't you go ahead and just dive into it?
So, Jorge Martin will be on a Ducati next year. In what team? We do not know. So, I think we are waiting for the divorce from KTM to become final, and they're going to decide at what time that they wish to announce Jorge, we wish you well, continued success, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you cannot blame Jorge Martin for wanting to get to MotoGP. I don't think he was exactly going to get there because the inn is kind of full at KTM. I mean, they've got four guys on MotoGP bikes, and every one of these guys is riding really pretty damn good. You know, you got to wonder with Pole leaving, who's going to take over the other true factory ride? Well, that's going to be Oliveira's, and then you have Lecuona, so on the Tech 3 bike, and then you're going to have somebody else replace him, but it seems like they've got that
figured out. Oh, no, Petrucci's coming over.
Yeah, that's right.
Remember? Yeah. Petrucci's coming over, so those seats are all locked up, so there was nowhere to go in the KTM team next year.
No, nowhere to go, so not a bad deal for Martin. You take it, take a MotoGP ride. When somebody throws you a contract, you take it. That's right. You don't know when those opportunities are going to come around again.
Exactly. We say that all the time.
Yeah, you say it all the time. The next part of news, Zarco got a new two-year deal with Ducati on what team? Ooh. We do not know yet. There's a theme to these if you haven't figured that out yet.
Right.
I was surprised Zarco got a deal, but then again, I'm really not. But he had a really good race in Brno, had a really good race in Austria going. You don't know where Dovizioso is going, and you know he's not there, so you kind of want to find someone. You know, you better to keep the devil you know than find a new one. So I guess that makes sense in that respect, but I'm not too sure. You know, I think Zarco might get a Pramac seat, because I think we know Miller is going to the actual factory team.
Yep.
Petrucci, does he still have a year on his deal, or is he done?
No, he's gone to KTM, remember?
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. You just said that, and somehow I forgot.
It's been a long week. We were talking about
long day,
the show.
Long week. Yeah. You know, Petrucci's going there, so over to KTM. So where, you know, I think Zarco slides in there on the, you know, he might slide into the factory team. I think Pramac probably more legit. Ducati still got some shopping to do to kind of fill up all of the seats, but they have a couple riders, so, you know, no big deal there. I mean, Pramac could be Martin and Zarco, and the factory team would be Miller and
Pecco Bagnaia.
And Bagnaia, yes.
Yeah. So this is where... no worries. So this is where it kind of gets interesting, right? Because where there's the Italian connection with Bagnaia, and they would love that to have another Italian, especially with one leaving the team. They do like to have that nice cohesiveness between country and bike and factory. But Zarco also brings a lot of experience to the team. And he's proven on the Ducati, well, at least last year's Ducati, that he's very quick. And he's been on pole, he's had chances at wins, he's set fastest laps, and this is his first year on it, right? So,
correct.
If you look at that, it's kind of like, okay, Pecco, we got to see there were some flashes of really exciting talent that's there, but since he's been hurt, it's hard to gauge that. So I think that's where Ducati is sitting back, right? They're like, okay, we want these guys to stay around, but they're the order, I think, won't be set until much later in the season when everybody's back and they get a much larger sample of where everyone's talent. I think the only person that we know where he's going to be in Ducati next year is Jack Miller. That's it. Everybody else is just it's a crapshoot.
It could be we wait until testing is done for 21 season and we sort it out then. You know?
That'd be tough. I mean, they do spread out their mechanics and their team across all of them. They treat them all kind of like sub-factory teams, not so much as privateers. But I think as far as that wouldn't be good for someone like Zarco, where he needs consistency, because once you ruffle his feathers, we've seen what happens. So
yes, we have.
If they're putting some chips in his basket, I'm pretty sure they want to lock him down and get his mind right. But then again, this may be from looking outside as a fan and not really knowing like the inner workings of GP and how people really think. So I don't know. Take it with what you will. It's anyone's guess at this time. And if you want to place your bets, go ahead.
Yeah, we should lay odds on the next show as to where everybody shows up at Ducati. That'd probably be pretty fun. We'll have to do some research on that and figure out where we think everybody's going to wind up at the spinning wheel of Ducati.
Right.
Another news item. Marc Marquez will be out for at least 2 more months to allow his humerus bone to heal properly. It was an interesting tweet that I saw from David Emmett that said, "Does anybody really miss Marc Marquez riding this year?" To me, the championship and the racing has been spectacular this year, which makes you think, yeah, did Mark really have much to do with that? Probably not. I mean, him not being there is obviously a part of it, I guess is what I really want to say. You know, we see everybody closer because he's sort of elite level talent, and I don't mind. I think the racing has been fantastic. I'm over the moon with how KTM is doing. It's a great season. The only thing is, I miss Marquez and those saves. I miss watching him be at the edge and beyond for 9 out of every 10 laps, it seems, and somehow pull off some miracle save somewhere along the way. And it's just crazy to watch, because he really does defy physics at times. Your mind just looks at that and goes, no, that did not happen. He really didn't do that, but yet he did do that. And you're grabbing the remote, you want to back up the tape, you want to watch it over and over again, because you just don't realize, your mind just doesn't grab hold of that physically actually happened right then. So yeah, definitely one of those things that it's great racing. I do miss Mark not being there, but I will not have anything bad to say about this season, because it has been fantastic. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's completely unpredictable this season with him being out. That's kind of, I think, maybe when he was leaning towards, does anybody miss him? It's like Marquez is almost, it's who can beat Marquez for the championship is how we looked at it when we first came into the season. Now we're looking at it as who can win the championship? Because even me and you got on the Quattraro boat maybe a little too early and we're thinking, man, who's going to touch this guy? Whoa, we gotta rein that in a little bit, because now it's anybody's game, right? And
very much so.
It will be, you know, without Mark, there's definitely a level of spectacular that is missing. But it also, you know, it kind of there's always going to be an asterisk to whoever wins this. Like, if Marquez was there, would you have won? But it doesn't matter. He's not there. But I do want to talk a little bit about why he's not there. And now, your wife is a trauma nurse. Is that am I right or am I wrong?
Well, my wife is actually a doctor, as okay. much as I. So, yeah, I mean, she is a pediatrician. So she sees kids with broken bones and et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, okay. She said initially 4 months.
Yeah. So here's, and maybe you can pose this question to her for the next show, because this is my theory. So one, we talked about how there needs to be checks and balances between doctors and MotoGP, and the doctors maybe don't need to be on the MotoGP payroll anymore because someone needs to be looking out for the best interests for these riders and not so much getting them back on the bike as soon as possible, because obviously things can go wrong. You need to heal. 5 days is not enough for a broken bone, even when you get a plate put in there. Now, after this whole thing has snapped, there's been way less, oh, look at him training, look at him getting back to it, look at him doing all of this. And then all of a sudden there's a quiet extension, like, oh, I'm going to be gone for 2, maybe even 3 more months. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, broken bone, we're looking at 6 to 8 weeks for the normal people around here to get back to kind of what they were doing. Athletes, a little bit, you know, they'll rush a little bit, but they won't be full speed. He could certainly be back if it was just a broken bone. My theory on this is the second time he broke it, it screwed something up and it gave him some nerve damage. And that takes a long time to heal. So my theory is that why it's been so quiet, it's worse than what we really think. And if these doctors have let him go through and do all of this training and everything else so quickly, he ends up hurting to himself where he damages his arm. And let's say it's the worst, where he can't really recover and gain the feeling back in his arm that he needs to ride a MotoGP bike, and he has to say adios to GP. That almost feels like, well, not really like you can't hold anybody liability because he wanted to come back. But dude, this is the worst case scenario that we're almost looking right down the barrel at right now.
I'm of the belief, rightly, wrongly, who knows, that he broke it, he screwed it up again, opening a window. I think that he went in there, got it done again, and I think Dr. Mir said, hey, you have got to let this thing heal. And in the statement that HRC made, they said, after further consultation, we are decided to, you know, not ride for another 2 months. My take is that Dr. Mir, who I think Marquez trusts implicitly, has said, look, you can't do this. There's no way unless you let your body rest, heal, and then we'll work on putting your strength back on, and then you can get back on a 280 horsepower motorcycle. That's my take. I hope that's what it is. I don't want to see Marquez have nerve damage. I don't want to see him not be able to race. I think a lot of us forget long ago he crashed a Moto2 bike at Sepang so bad that he did something with the muscle in his eye. And I don't remember exactly what, whether he had detached the muscle from what controls your eye or holds it in place, but he had to have that surgically repaired, and he was, you know, missed the rest of the year and had the whole off season to recover and come out of there. And there's a good chance that he may not have ridden a bike after that. So I think he's dodged one bullet, and I think he's kind of half dodged this bullet. And I think he understands that, hey, look, there's no way I can win this championship realistically. So I better just wait it out, get healed up, come back next year, come out hard, strong, and hey, we might even have a better front end on this motorcycle thanks to Paul Espargaro, and just clean house next year. That's my take.
Yeah. Well, I think we spent enough time on that. We're already 15 minutes in the show. We haven't got to a single race yet, but there's still a little bit of news. And we're going to continue on the injury bug there. But Jack Miller, who sustained a shoulder injury in FP4, and we want to know, how bad is that going to affect him?
Yeah, I think it was FP4. I can't remember where it was when I was writing this out. But they were talking about it during the race that Jack had a small crash, and his shoulder was kind of feeling it. I don't think it's... I don't think it's in the same vein as like Ren's is shoulder where it dislocated or anything like that. I think it's more of one of those things where it was an injury that was more sore, and mm-hmm. you could see that when they, you know, during the race there was, you know, hey, I'm not giving anything away, there's a red flag, and Miller was being worked on for being massaged on, and he, you know, I think it's just one of those things where it's a, it's more of a muscular thing where, or maybe like a deep bone bruise that's hurting him, but mm-hmm. Not really sure. And they're being tight-lipped about his exact injury, which I really can't blame them for that.
No, especially because once everybody gets a little sniff, then everybody wants to know, and it's taking away from what's most important, and that is the race itself. Speaking of which, yeah. We got a little qualifying to get through. Now, let me repeat myself, because as the same as last week, I didn't get a chance to watch Moto3 and Moto2 qualifying because, well, my Saturdays have very limited time these days, so I got to get in what I can get in and watch what I can watch. But, Jim, why don't you go ahead and just run us through some highlights?
Moto3 QP1. In is Masia, Antonelli, Sasaki, Anshu, and Binder. Pretty much, I think we think those guys are kind of the ones that are usually there. Again, the racing now is so tight that anyone could really be, you know, four fast guys that are going to be in this first qualifying session. Really, there's not a whole lot that goes on in this first session except for Masia somehow crashes at turn six. Now, I never saw the crash. I watched everything. It was definitely one of these things that was not caught on any camera that at least the Dorna feed that I saw showed anybody. But when we pick it up, there is gravel all over the racetrack, and Mossy is standing there with no gloves on.
Ooh.
So okay, what happened to his gloves? Because that's sort of the first thing that you think about.
Right.
I think Matt Burt said that maybe he went sliding across the track and he sort of had that heat burn going on. So he ripped the gloves off to see if his hands were okay or at least get rid of the heat. Very possible. No idea what really happened. If anybody knows exactly what happens, please, you know, tweet me or email us because I really want to know what happened here. But he then goes to pick the bike back up. He pulls it out of the gravel trap. The fairing is damaged. He rips that off. So he has a fairingless bike. They start it back up. He goes riding back to the pits with no gloves. And he gets from 6 to just the beginning of turn 9. And suddenly the bike just starts flinging oil in its best Exxon Valdez moment. There's just oil everywhere across the track, all the way into the pit lane, necessitating a lengthy delay to put it back up. What had happened, according to Simon Crafar from the pit lane, was that there is a oil tube that runs under the motor that had come loose, and literally the bike started pumping and just started pumping all this oil out of the motor. It's amazing that Masia actually rode it back without literally crashing, but they took a lot of time, threw down a lot of oil dry to clean it up because it was pretty much on the apex of turn 9, which no one wants that to happen, but it did. And even in front of their pit box, it was horrifying. It looked like they had the desert there. All they needed was to throw out a couple of lawn chairs, a palm tree, and a Corona, and they'd have been at the beach. There was so much sand that was there. They actually brought out one of those big vacuum trucks to vacuum up the oil dry and the sand and grit and everything. The bike was started again in pit lane, and the technical directors were there looking at it to be sure that it wasn't going to leak anymore. But the stewards decided that he needed to not start the session as a penalty for irresponsible riding, i.e. oiling the track, and irresponsible riding, you did not have the proper safety equipment that is deemed necessary for it, yeah. i.e. where are your gloves? Although we did later on see video that the corner worker had them. So again, I don't know how these gloves come off, but I imagine him hopping up after sliding across the asphalt and ripping them off and throwing them, and the corner worker just happens to walk over and pick them up. So
yeah, a little souvenir.
It's a little souvenir action there. So that is that's how it went out. So Masia went through with Antonelli, Anshu, and Binder. They all get on into the second qualifying session. The second qualifying session, well, that was nothing but a bunch of in and out laps, because area was trying to clean off the track because we had all the oil dry that was down. We had 7 minutes left and nobody had really set a pole time at all. Eventually, they finally did get down to it and they started running through some quick laps and they started to get the feel of the track. It was definitely much slower. There wasn't the grip that these guys were used to there. Everybody was like running wide at the turn nine area just because of that oil dry. Rodrigo was on pole. Arbolino had a pole lap going. He was right there, but that lap got scrubbed because he had track limits. And then, you know, like I said, everyone was just running wide at turn nine. No one could challenge Rodrigo, who would start on pole. Raul Fernandez was second. Then we had Suzuki, Arbolino, Vietti, McPhee, Foggia, Agra, and Arenas, our championship leader there in ninth on the third row. Darren Binder would start 10th, and that was qualifying for Moto 3.
That is insane. The amount of oil dry, you know, getting back on your bike without the proper gear. I mean, that's why there's series that have switched to, I think BSB does it. Moto America did it. It was DMG that actually, I think, did it, and Moto America went back. But now, once you crash your bike, I mean, that was it. No matter low side, high side, didn't matter. Once you were off the track, you're not coming back on. And this for a lot of reasons such as that.
Yeah. There was a lot of talk about that in the time between the two qualifying sessions.
Oh, I'm sure.
That this was going to become a topic, like, hey, if you crash, you're done, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. I get that logic. I see it, but these guys don't have two bikes, nor do the Moto 2 guys. So I don't think it's fair to say if you crash, you can't get back up and bring it in. But I know, and again, this is not the best scenario that happened because the pipe eventually came off as the bike started moving and vibrating. But I remember, you know, distinctly, like we would run WIRA races. If you crashed, and WIRA defined a crash as if the handlebar touches the ground, that's a crash. When the corner workers got to you, there was a head corner worker who had tech written on his jersey, a penny or something that denoted him as a tech. And he would look the bike over once you got it started again, and you would not be released again until he deemed that motorcycle capable of getting back to the pits, where you then had to be go through a tech again before they let you out. Of course, that's club racing. I think they could kind of institute something like that at MotoGP level, where you have someone who is an official tech at that corner. He makes a decision as to whether or not that bike is capable of being ridden back to the pits. And if it is, they allow it to go. Which I think that's sort of the happy medium. And I think that's kind of where we may wind up with something of that magnitude.
Yeah, it'd be good to see something like that, but that kind of goes back to what I think they really need to do is have a traveling corner worker team that needs to go with them. That way you have people who know the bikes, know how to take care of the bikes, know where all the safety measures are. You have the same doctors that can attend to the riders. They're specifically trained for, you know, motorcycle crashes and anything like that, how to watch the track. They go through rigorous training. And you know, having this tech thing here, that's another great point of having it on. I think that'd be a great move. And I know a lot of people who do volunteer, they do great work, but at the same point, I think when you are at the pinnacle of racing, you're at the very top level, and then you cheap out and want volunteers to do your corner working, that's when I'm kind of like, well, I mean, you are the pinnacle. So maybe you should have a professional team there too.
Well, I was just trying to think, I was counting in my head, which track has the most turns. Somehow I think Sepang does, but I'm not 100% certain on that one. But you would probably need maybe 15 corner workers, because that person I'm thinking would be like corner captain, and mm-hmm. they would be the traveling team that Dorna has that goes to all the races. So that one person there is the corner captain. He's the guy who's going to tech the bike back again. But you could still have the volunteers and the
That's
people from the clubs under his guidance working together to get. For the safety part of it, the medical team, I think you could probably, it would be nice to have something like that, but I mean, you already have Clinica Mobile, which takes care of the guys already. So it could be, you just had more people from Clinica Mobile out at the different corners of the racetrack. So, or, you know, yeah. Maybe strategically positioned at places that you would be the highest probability right. of incidents, maybe something of that nature. But I think we should talk about the Moto3 race.
I think so too.
All right. So at the beginning, Rodrigo and Arbolino, they got out to a hole shot. McPhee had an engine change that morning. They found something that they did not quite like, so they did change McPhee's engine. So, ooh, he had a fresh one. So I was thinking maybe there might be a little something there with McPhee. Mm-hmm. However, it was early days. We had Anshu, who was coming up fast through the pack. Then he got a great hole shot that was there. Also, Bender got another great start. I mean, there was like, 16 laps to go, and Bender was running third, so he was at the front almost instantaneously. Arbolino looked good on the Honda. That bike had some speed. I mean, he didn't even really need the draft again, so whatever was missing in the check round and at the first round in Austria has been corrected. Now, whether that's just simply a tired engine and he got a new one, not too sure. No one was saying anything. But Arbolino's bike was back to being the rocket ship that we saw in Jerez. With 14 laps to go, it got aggressive at that point. It had been, in my mind, a fairly calm, very sort of processional, I wouldn't say professional, but a processional race with just some nice passing here and there. But man, yeah. Elbows came out at that point. Right, Bender was going...
Well, because before, like you had mentioned, it was calm, especially compared to the race we had just a week ago, where it was elbows out from the get-go. And like you said, it was a very much more methodical, thought-out passing instead of the, I'm just going to throw it up here and see how it sticks kind of way. But then we get to the point where you're getting to where it's just like, all right, here we go, lights on, it's back to being Moto3.
Yeah, it suddenly became Moto3 again. By halfway, Arbolino was out front, Rodrigo was there. Bender was up there, Sasaki, Agura, Anshu was there. All the big guys are running around. McPhee was in it there for a little bit. Vietti had gone back to the front. I'm thinking, wow, Vietti might win two in a row here. But Arbolino, every time Vietti would get in front, Arbolino would kind of running back down again. McPhee kind of went to the back a little bit. Then he came back towards the front again. Suddenly, Bender was going backwards, kind of as we've seen before, where I think you may be right, he overheats that front tire with his very hard braking that he does, and that gets him to the front early on, but he can't sustain the pace because the tires cannot hold up to it. So he was going backwards, and then we had the big incident of the race. There was 5 laps to go, and then Anshu is going into turn 1. Oof. And I think he got caught up in a double bike draft and just underestimated when he needed to start braking. Mm-hmm. Because he slams on the brakes and you can see him sort of go, uh-oh, I'm not going to stop in time. And he goes for a little more of a squeeze and that causes the front to fold on him. And when the front folds, he slides over and takes out his teammate in the Tech 3 team, Sasaki. So they both go down, and they both are there on the ground, and it was Sasaki had so many barrel rolls. I mean, he was just rolling. I'd have been dizzy and wanted to vomit after having gone through that.
I think he did 10.
He might have. It was crazy that he had rolled that many times.
No, it's a big bummer too because Sasaki had been up in the front, and it looked like he was biding his time where he was. He wasn't dropping back. He definitely had the speed to run at the front of the race. Denise wasn't looking as strong as he did the previous week. He, was pushing a little bit harder. I think, with the renewed confidence that he had from last week, it got him sucked into that little bit of trouble like you mentioned where he just got on the brakes too hard and maybe lifted the back tire, then it caught grip and folded up the front a little bit. But it definitely a bad way for KTM Tech 3 to start their weekend.
Ooh, very much so. To me, the interesting point at here was that Arenas was nowhere to be found at all. This is kind of becoming his MO. He just suddenly appears at the front with about 5 laps to go. He had come from 11th, where he spent the vast majority of the race, which is only about a second to a second and a half from the lead. And with a few laps to go, he had suddenly become 5th and seemed to have the energy, the well to go forward. It's like, ooh, Reynolds may be able to get a win here with this. He just sort of shows up there. Vietti and Agüero, they sort of throw everything at Arbolino. But Arbolino's bike is just so fast that if they outbrake him going into one of the turns, Arbolino just kind of hooks it wide, lets it run in a little deep, late apexes earlier than they do, tucks underneath and just powers back past them. That would wait for a couple laps. Again, Arbolino's bike was definitely a missile here this weekend.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, they may have misplaced or forgot to do or whatever was not misplaced this time, because the bike was definitely flying. McPhee was in with a shout until two laps to go, turn nine, front end, down goes McPhee, trying a little bit too hard maybe, perhaps.
Yep.
But it's down now to where it's between Arbolino and Vietti. They're the two guys that are going to settle this one, and we're waiting to see how this is going to work out. And you know what? Here comes Vietti. He rides basically the lap of his life to beat Arbolino to the line. Ayagura then comes in at third. Rodrigo was fourth. Arenas was fifth. That has been his worst finish in the last, four or five races, which was pretty impressive for him. I think Arbolino was probably going to win it, but he lost the front end in 10, and it was just enough where he couldn't get on the throttle where he wanted to get to drive, and it's just that little bit gave Vietti the way to take the win, and that is the race.
Now, Moto 3, another good race. You know, Vietti, is that his first win?
I think it is his first. I think it's the first win he had. He had the podium the prior weekend.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was near the podium, but this one he got.
And you can see it looked like he learned a little bit from last week. He saved a little bit of tires this time, and definitely he came on good towards the end of the race, especially. I even have it in my notes where before the crash between Anshu and Sasaki, I said, "Oh, Vietti's looking good, looking calm, but has the ability to just wick it up and pass people and get up one, two spots." Kind of like Arenas had before, where it's like, okay, you can't really worry about him being in eighth place, because at any point that he wants to, he'll just pass guys in a couple of corners and get right to the front as soon as he wants to. And he definitely had that this weekend. He put it all together and got himself a win, and it was an impressive win at that. And the VR46 boys just put another one on the shelf.
Yep, they did. I think it was another great ride by Arenas. It's the kind of ride that you need. He finished fifth. That's not anything to really sneeze at. I mean, if you can continue to ride and be in the top five week in, week out, you're going to wind up being the champion in this class, and you're going to be a champion by a mile, because he is the only one who is really being consistent. Now, I don't want this to become like the 2006 Nicky Hayden title, where, you know, it was all good at the beginning and then things kind of went downhill for Nicky, and he kind of, you know, he put it together at the end. I'm not trying to take anything away from Nicky winning the title, but it was one of these like, well, hey, I got a big cushion. I don't want Arenas to be, I have this really big cushion, so I'm just going to slide on into the championship here at the end.
Yeah.
He needs to maintain what he's doing and keep going, but he's definitely still sitting in the catbird seat for this title.
Oh, he certainly is, and he is still probably the most threatening rider this year. When he wants to, he wants to go fast. I think, like you had mentioned, he just wasn't as strong this weekend, where the guys around him had figured something out that their team didn't quite get on, and he was protecting his championship more so, where he's like, okay, I'll take this. These guys up front, you know, I'm not going to get involved in this and make it out of hand. I don't think we'll see that for the rest of the year, though. He's definitely got a good head on his shoulders, and we'll see him back up, maybe grabbing one or two more before the year ends.
Yeah, I think it's going to be more of a Wayne Rennie-esque style that he's going to employ. If this is the best I can do today, that's fine. If I can take the win, I will win. If it's just a podium, I'll take just a podium. And that's a great way to ride. It's a championship riding style. And I think we've talked about this before. I think we both agree that Arenas will be in a Moto 2 bike somewhere next year. I think McPhee goes to a bigger bike next year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Bender goes to a bigger bike next year.
Yep.
I think those are the guys that are going to graduate and move on. And then we'll, you know, it'll be a whole different cast of characters that are going to be running around trying to figure out who's going to win who. The Japanese guys, Agura, Suzuki. They're all teenagers still. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, they're definitely good. They're just not there yet. And, you know, you're just seeing guys like Arenas and McPhee and Bender, who have been around that class a lot longer, using their racing knowledge of the class to produce pretty good results. So absolutely. Let's look at the championship now, unless you have something else.
If you don't. No, we're good.
All right, so Albert Arenas leads the championship on 106 points. He's followed by Agura, McPhee, Vietti, who jumped up with those big 25 points that he collected. Then we have Arbolino, Suzuki, Fernandez, Rodrigo, Masia, Foggia, and then Darren Bender tied for 10th with Dennis Foggia. On to Moto2 qualifying. So in Moto2, in the first qualifying session, we had Vierge, right?
Yep.
Because I got to get the two straight because they're...
Yeah, I was looking at the initials too, and I was like...
They're so close. You got to make sure you get it right. So it's Vierge. Michel Schroeder, Chantra, they were all there in that first session. Nakagami was there as well. And it basically, there's not a whole lot that goes into this one, except that Vietti puts in a great ride with 4.5 laps to go to be in there, but he winds up getting bumped at the very end by Hector Garzo. So that left him going out and left Marcel Schroeder also missing and not going on to the Q2 session. In the Q2 session, Canet had a blistering 128.7. He then used that to knock Jorge Martin off of the pole position, along with Marini as well. That Canet looked fabulous on the speed-up chassis, having turned in that great time. He looked like he was able to use what we think of as that great edge grip, because Canet was very fast through the 6, 7, 8 combination of turns. Well, I guess it's really 5, 6, 7, and 8 combination of turns, and that's where he was really making his time. His sector, fast sectors were that section there, which is the kind of flowy, hook the lines up kind of a section, and he was capitalizing on it with the speed up. I think also they found something in the setup. He seemed to look very confident with what he had. He was definitely in control of the bike, instead of sometimes riders are kind of ridden by the bike and sometimes riders ride the bike. And I think Canet was kind of being ridden by the bike, and now he's sort of riding the bike. So it sort of made it all go together. Nakagami, he was in there as well, but he kind of fell off a little bit. Or Nakashima was, sorry, Nakashima, not Nakagami. His Nakashima was third there. Then you had Augusto Fernandez, Bezecchi. Remy Gardner looked pretty good in sixth. Luthi was seventh. Hector Garzo, after his great ride to Pimp Vietti in the first session, was only eighth quickest. And then Navarro, who's just had a terrible season, was ninth on the other speed up, which you thought, given what Canet was doing, you would have thought that perhaps maybe Navarro would have done just as well with his speed up. Not necessarily the case.
Mm-mm. Not a year for him at all.
Yeah. So, let's move to the Moto2 race.
Sure. I'll run us through a little bit of this one since I've actually seen it.
Okay.
So, the future Ducati man, Jorge Martin, got the whole shot over the pole sitter, Aaron Canet. And then shortly on the first lap there, Augusto Fernandez, he ended up crashing in the penultimate corner. Not the start that he wanted for sure. And then shortly after that, right there on turn four, on lap four, Aaron Canet got a little wide, a little deep on the brakes and lost the front end. And he was gone, which is a bit of a shame because he was so strong in the previous race last week that he was definitely going to be a shoo-in, obviously sitting on pole for the win. So a bit of a bummer that we lost him there. But what this did is it allowed the two KTM bikes of Martin and Nakashima to kind of clear off at the front and be a 1-2. And it was like, you start to wonder to yourself, like, oh man, is it going to be one of those weekends where those two guys get away and it's all for nothing? Hard to tell at this point. And then we had a crash with Sam Lowes. Sam Lowes came way too hot and onto the brakes. He was trying to make it past. I don't think his qualifying was that great, so he was trying to make up some spaces. I think he qualified like 11th or something like that.
Yeah, Lowes qualified 11th.
Yeah, he came up to the back of the pass, got into the race, ended up crashing, but he ended up taking out Jorge Navarro, whose season continues to be abysmal. This one was definitely not on his own. And Chantra. And that was a bad one. I mean, that was... I mean, these riders are really great, but even the announcers had to admit that he took a bit of his brain out on that one and made a really bad mistake for someone who's so experienced, and especially, I don't know, on these bikes and MotoGP. Just a mistake you didn't want to see him make. But then we saw at this point, Gardner was starting to run down the leaders, which was good because we didn't want those guys pulling completely away. And Gardner had been looking fast all week. And we cut back. Sam Load had crashed again, and this time at turn four, they gave him the black flag. They said, look, dude, your weekend, it's over. And the red mist must have set in, and Sam was just trying to get back on pace. And we don't want to see that Sam Lowe's come back. We want to see front runner Moto 2, not in the gravel all the time, Sam Lowe. So hopefully this is a one-off and he gets himself back together, back to what we saw previously this year.
Gets it back together again, because he was on a strong run of mm-hmm. good finishes and kind of building the confidence up that he needed with the team. You know, he's on a very good team. He's on the team that won the championship last year.
Mm-hmm. And good old Mark Vidius.
Yes. I don't get where Lowe's mind was in this one.
Mm.
I mean, because at first I thought he had gotten black flagged and then fell the second time, I believe is how it went down. And I'm like, oof, that's a pretty steep penalty to be black flagged for what you did. And then I went back and watched that crash over again. Man, it is literally like Lowe's just... I almost thought that maybe Lowe's had a braking problem with the bike. Mm. Because it's just so out of character for him.
Yeah.
Of what he was trying to do and where he was. I thought he had a bike problem. And I have not found anywhere that he had a bike problem. And pretty much he just said, I screwed up. Which, yeah, you did. And that I really wish I could understand what he was thinking or not thinking. Because it's just so not Sam Lowe's. No. Not in any way, shape, or form. So I was gutted to see him do it. I was gutted to see him get a black flag for it. However, I think the black flag was totally justified given what he did and the fact that it could have been even worse than what it was. I think they sort of got kind of lucky that everyone was okay. And I think MotoGP had to do something just because of what happened the prior weekend with Zarco and Morbidelli. I think you're going to see a little more scrutiny on these guys. That when it's a real brain fade moment, I do not think that the officials are going to be shy about using that black flag again.
No, I don't think so either.
I'll let you go on now.
Yeah. So at this point, Gardner had finally run down and got by Nagashima, and it looks like he was getting ready to run down Martin. I have a little side note into here. This is sometimes you got things to think about. I was like, whatever happened to Nicola Bulega? Because I was like, he came up and was like, okay, he had a good couple years in Moto 3. Then it was like he got too big for the bike. He was going to go to Moto 2. And he just, like, where is he? Like, we haven't seen him. And we've seen, like, Bezzecchi come up and do well. We've seen Martin come up and do well. But he just seems to be one of those guys that maybe he's just hit his wall. Anyway, keep moving forward. Bezzecchi at this point had gotten by Nagashima for third. Nagashima was starting to slide back. He couldn't quite keep the pace that Martin was setting, and the other guys had sped up. And then Bezzecchi had gotten by Gardner, who had a nice drive out of turn three to get the job done going down to turn four. Bezzecchi was looking really, really strong and consistent, but Martin had a huge gap at this point, and he was safe, or so we thought. And so the gap to Martin started coming down with about seven laps to go, and you knew the last two laps were going to be good because it was tense every corner. It was like watching a countdown clock right in front of you. It was like, oh, the gap is 1.7, 1.6, 1.5, 1.4. It just kept coming like that every corner. And the Bezzecchi was getting closer and closer. But when you were thinking to yourself, oh, man, I don't know if he's going to have enough time. Where's it going to be? And then Martin was looking real strong. He started riding defensive. It's like, oh, he's riding defensive. That means Bezzecchi's really going to come close if he's getting in there. And then we get down to the last little bit, the last couple of corners. Martin holds it. He crosses the line, and he gets the win. But he didn't, because when we ran back, just like last week, on the last lap, he got a little wide coming out of turn seven, got on the rumble strips, got over on the 8, and just by a few inches got his tires on the green, which is out of bounds. And if you run wide on the last lap in Austria, we know what the penalty is, don't we, Jim?
You
lose a place. That's right. And so he lost position. Bezzecchi gets his first win in Moto2 with that benefit to him. Martin drops down. He was a little upset, but at the same time, what you going to do? It is what it is. Still second place. Bezzecchi goes good. And these were two guys that were big rivals in Moto3. Not the friendliest. And they pull over on the cooldown lap. Many hugs, fist bumps, everything else. It's good to see that. You remember that. It's just a sport. These guys love it. It was fun. It was great to see Bezzecchi get his first win. But honestly, I think he really earned it. He ran him down from a long way back. And given another lap, I think he would have got him anyway.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't besmirch Bezzecchi's win. It was well earned. The guy kept his head down and was just a tenth faster every lap and just kept it going the whole way. It was, like you said, it was a countdown. You were waiting for him to get there. Is there enough laps for him to get there? And if he gets there, is he going to be able to get by Martin? Now, I'm all for you have to have rules, track limits, etc. The one thing that kind of bugs me on this one is, I agree, turn 8, Martin is beyond the track limit. However, if you look at that video, I am not so certain that Bezzecchi is not guilty of the same problem.
They never slowed it down enough to see, right?
Right. They never did slow it down enough for you to see what actually is happening to Bezzecchi. I'm making my judgment that Bezzecchi makes the same infraction Martin does because he's in the draft behind Martin trying to get enough of a run to get beside him to outbreak him going to 9. If Bezzecchi's right there, I don't see how he can be in and Martin is out. Now, maybe there's another camera angle or something that Dorna has and the officials have that clearly shows that he's absolutely inside of it. From the only camera angle that we were presented, I'm on the fence as to whether Bezzecchi was actually out of bounds. If Bezzecchi was actually in bounds. Martin is out of bounds. That's not a question. But in my mind, if both of them created the same foul, then it's Martin's win. It isn't Bezzecchi's. But I'm not the guy in race control, and I don't see all the finite details that they actually have to look at to decide that. I just thought, ooh, from that camera angle, Bezzecchi looks like he's across that line too, and he's touching some green because they have been very strict about just even touching that green, let alone getting the wheels off of it and all the wheels onto it. You know, especially we saw that in the turn 10 area. And, you know, because at first I thought, well, they were really close coming out of the last turn to being beyond the white line at 10, which is, I thought, what they were going to get Martin on. Well, then they showed it at turn 8. I'm like, was that really 8? And I had to back it up to be sure that it was actually turn 8 because I was like, whoa, is it really? But, you know, it is racing. I think Martin handled it really well. I think it was all jovial and fun. I think what was nice was he had a discussion with the officials as to what the reasoning was behind the penalty that he was given, and he calmly explained it from his side. The officials were calm about it. There wasn't a bunch of stomping up and down, screaming, jumping, throwing your toys out of the pram kind of a thing, mm-hmm. which is kind of cool. But then again, if I got a Ducati contract in my back pocket, I really may not be caring whether I win this actual Moto2 race especially or not,
maybe,
right?
Maybe he got it that weekend, too.
Exactly. We don't know. So, yeah, it's just one of those things where, Martin definitely should have been penalized. I'm just curious as to whether Bezzecchi should have been penalized for the same thing. That's my only thing.
Yeah, you know, tough call, but we don't have to make him because I don't think you win either way.
Yeah, so part of me sometimes thinks like, yeah, I want to be one of these official type guys who does this solely from the standpoint of I've raced at a club level, and I'm like, I think I could be pretty good at it. And then I see like that picture, and I'm going, nah, I can't make that call. No, I don't want any part of it.
No, thank you. So that brings us to the results. Now, like we said, Marco Bezzecchi gets his first win in front of Jorge Martin. Remy Gardner with a nice, strong third place there. Had he not burned up his tires a bit, he was definitely going to be a shoe in there. Tsuga Nagashima finishes in fourth. He was able to maintain there. Thomas Luthi making a nice appearance back towards the front of the field. Seems to be finally getting the front end of that bike figured out. In front of Xavi Virahe, Luca Marini had a seventh place. Not his strongest weekend, but I'm sure he'll be back in the front in no time. Jake Dixon with a nice top 10 there in 8th. Hector Garzo in 9th. Enea Bastianini in 10th. Definitely not doing his championship much favor, especially after last weekend. Marshall Schwader, Joe Roberts, for anyone paying attention to the American there, in 12th. Not a bad race for him as well. Nico Bellega, the guy I was, the mystery man I was wondering about there, in 13th in front of Manzi and Lorenzo Baldassare. And that wraps out your top 15, which moves us into our championship. Luca Marini still sitting on top of the championship. He's up there by 8 points on 87 points. 8 points in front of Enea Bastianini. Jorge Martin is tied with Enea Bastianini now, courtesy of that second place. And second and third there in the championship. Nagashima is now fourth in the championship, only 3 points ahead of Marco Bezzecchi, who's making a nice strong run up towards the front of the championship himself. Sam Lowes drops to 6th place. He's on 59 points in front of Xavi Virahe. Aaron Canet, the rookie, looking good with a nice 8th place in the championship so far. Remy Gardner there in 9th. And Joe Roberts rounding out the top 10 in qualifying. Or excuse me, top 10 in the championship. Got ahead of myself reading in the notes, because the next thing coming up is MotoGP qualifying. Jim?
In the MotoGP qualifying session, in the first session, we had Zarco, Binder, Rossi, and Kyle Crutchlow. Not too surprising. Again, the people who are in the first qualifying session are going to just get traded in and out. There's just so many good riders doing so well that it's mere tenths that's keeping you from being in or out.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty crazy. Rossi and Binder, they threw down late in the Q1 session to try to get in. Lecuona had gone to first. He bumped Rossi. Zarco went by to take first. He bumped Binder. And Rossi crashed at turn 9. He lost the front end. And then Petrucci comes in to bump Lecuona to out of the first session, preventing him from going to the second session. In the second session, you had Espargaro, who had been quick most of the weekend. Looked like he was going to be on pole. He was sitting there. Quartararo took a couple attempts at it, but Quartararo looked really bad. He was struggling terribly this weekend. He definitely was not getting the grip, didn't have the speed, really didn't seem to have anything going for him at all.
Nope. And then, no confidence in the brakes either.
Yeah, well, we'll get onto that. You have to hold up there, pump your Brembos just to see if they work. Anyway, Nakagami was crazy good. Like, he just came, I mean, it feels like he came out of nowhere to be really close to being on pole. And he even had a lap. He just kept getting faster. Like, he just kept knocking tenths off. Like, who's coming around with another really good lap? Ooh, here comes Nakagami's got a chance at pole. And he did, except he ran wide. He broke track limits, and so he had his pole, what would have been a pole lap, scrubbed from it. Zarco took a flying leap at it to try to get up there. He wound up being really quick as well in trying to be at or near the pole. And, you know, basically, at the end, Paul Espargaro held on to score a pole position for KTM. I believe KTM's first pole position. First pole position in MotoGP. Nakagami was second quick. Zarco was third quick. Now, Zarco was going to have to go start from the pit lane because of his problems in the previous weekend's race, which we all know about. That was Zarco's penalty for his irresponsible riding. Was, hey, you're going to start from pit lane. Again, we got to go back. Does punishment fit the crime? Well, I think MotoGP had to do something. And I think that was a reasonable deal, was to say, hey, Zarco is going to start from pit lane.
Now, I have a question while we're on the subject here. If he has to start from pit lane, why is he allowed to qualify at all?
You know, there's nothing that says that you can't, right? I mean, because you're going to be induced that you're going to be issued that penalty after you're done. I mean, I have the same question about that in Formula One. So, hey, you know, you got a guy who's going to receive a 5-place penalty from his grid position because he changed the gearbox or whatever. Well, they're out there flying around throwing softs on just so they can go farther up the grid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It seems counterintuitive, but I think they did it more as a team kind of a concept. You know, I think the Ducatis knew that if they could get Zarco up in the mix, that would push a KTM one spot further back on the grid. That would push Rossi one bike farther back on the grid. I think Ducati realized that their biggest problem this weekend was going to be the Suzukis, because they looked really good. And if you could put Zarco up ahead of them, well, that pushes them back one place. So that gives you the potential of, well, kicking them off of a third row onto a fourth row, maybe. Or, you know, so they're not going to, you know, be farther up. So I think it was more just a strategy thing than anything else that was there. Now, Juan Mir on the Suzuki was fourth, looking fabulous on the Suzuki. We know that they were fast the previous weekend. Miller was only fifth fastest. Vinales was sixth. Rins was seventh, looking good as well. Miguel Oliveira was eighth on the KTM. And then you had Dovizioso, who now suddenly seemed to have lost the plot. Like, Dovi was really good last weekend, and this weekend, like, whoa, what happened, bud?
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't really figure out what was going on there at that. Then you got the Yamahas, and, you know, Morbidelli and Quartararo. Sorry, Quartararo, then Morbidelli. And Petrucci rounding out the 12 fastest guys in MotoGP.
Right, and this was Quartararo's. This tied him for his worst qualifying in MotoGP, too, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of shocking that, I mean, the Yamahas are so far out of whack. And it seemed to be this incredibly flippy, floppy thing. It's like last weekend the Ducatis were really, really, really fast. But, you know, they had race pace to go with it. Well, this time they weren't even fast, and Dovizioso didn't even look fast. He didn't even have pace in FP4. But you looked at the Suzukis, they had some outstanding pace in all this. And I remind you, you know, I got to thinking, like, wow, Suzuki really has kind of come on song here. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of amazing that they're actually doing this. And then I kind of remembered back long, long ago to preseason testing. I don't know if you can remember back that far, Skyler, but remember Rins on the last day of testing? He quit early. And he was walking around like he had a Cheshire cat grin, like strutting the pit lane, like, yeah, baby, we got something here. And I think we both sort of kind of shrugged that off as like egotistical overconfidence. No, I think he knew what Suzuki had. And I think Suzuki really does have something. And it was one of these deals where it's coming around and we just haven't seen Rins really do anything because he wound up having that terrible crash at Jerez that, you know, hurt his shoulder. But Mir has kind of taken up that mantle of being best Suzuki and whatnot. In the race, though, as we start off and things get going.
There was one thing I wanted to bring up, because you had mentioned the Yamahas and their struggles, and a lot of that was a testament that all of them were complaining about the brakes, especially Fabio Quartararo, and this was after going to the larger rotors.
340 mil rotors.
So while they were discussing during qualifying, one of the things is that there's teams that aren't having problems with the brakes. They run a different caliper. And it was something along the lines, and I probably won't get the name exactly right, but there was like a high-density caliper, and then there wasn't.
High mass.
There it is. High mass. So the high-mass calipers. Any team that was running the high-mass calipers was not having any issues with the brakings, but the teams that weren't, like Yamaha, were. And to the point where even the announcers were like, we don't really know why they haven't switched to this, and MotoGP just going forward may actually say, hey, these are the calipers that you have to run because, one, they have more stopping power, they're less prone to overheating, and they're safer, which is important for something when it happens and gets to the race. So how do you want to do the race, Jim? You want to go flag to flag to flag? Like, you want to do, like, I'll do the first half of the race, so you do the second, or what do you want to do here?
let's do that, but allow me to add a little more to the Yamaha thing here.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that Yamaha and Vinales kept the low mass calipers, and they did that because he felt like that felt better to him. Like, he had better feel, which is a rider thing, which you're entitled to do. But if they were running the high mass calipers, what happens is because you got more mass, you're able to hold more heat and you can dissipate that heat because they actually have like a wing built into it. So that as you thin out material, the only kind of way I can actually describe it is if you computer geeks have built your own computer, you know you have a heat sink on top of your Intel chipset or your AMD set or whatever you have.
That's AMD,
a
baby.
Big
AMD.
Mass of aluminum with some very fine, very fine fins that are on there. Well, that's a way to actually make the heat flow through the material and flow away from the chip and then dissipate the heat out. Well, that's kind of what's happening in MotoGP. And Yamaha's problem then gets pushed to become even more severe when they're racing, because one, you're in the draft of somebody else three times a lap, so you're not getting as much cooling air to the brakes as you would if you were by yourself. And since you're down on horsepower, you brake a lot later and a lot harder, which puts a lot more energy into the brakes and hence a lot more heat. So they sort of compounded their own problem. But Brembo has now said that this track is the toughest track for MotoGP bikes on brakes. And I think you're going to see a rule instituted that everybody's going to have to run the high mass and the high mass rotors that are 340 instead of 320 millimeters, just for the stopping power and whatnot. So just a little bit of physics back in there. The race, there was rain lurking. There was the gray cloud, which represented some cooler track temperatures, which I think might have been where some of the people were not being as fast as what we thought they would or should be, because the track temperatures were cooler. It was definitely interesting on the front row. Pol had a hard front, medium rear. Taka had a medium front, soft rear. And then you had Mir, who was on a soft combination. Mir had an excellent hole shot. That hole shot device that Suzuki has is absolutely brilliant. It works very, very well. Pol got going backwards because he definitely had a very poor start. Mm-hmm. Miller got up into the front ahead of Mir and Tatsuki, but Quartararo was down in 13th. Binder now looks to be like the new Rossi. He doesn't qualify very well, but boy, he races really well on Sunday. So he sort of kind of came on and was going at it. Mir had then finally figured out that after having attempted passing Miller a couple times and having Miller come back by him again with the speed of the Ducati, that he had to make a pass somewhere towards the end of the lap, use the flowy part of the circuit to get ahead, which is what he did. And he ran some ball-busting hot laps to get in front of Miller and put a gap on Miller. In fact, Mir winds up now at this point just basically starting to pull away. I think he had almost 2 second lead on everyone, which was amazing. I mean, it looked like Paul Asperger from the week before. Out front, nobody going to touch him, ripping off the laps. This thing's going to be perfect. He seriously had pace. Miller was definitely there with Nakagami. Asperger, Rins, they were all right there. And Paul finally seemed at some point to have settled in after about 4 or 5 laps. He calmed himself down. I thought, okay, get it together. Just start clicking it off. You got a little pace. Get something going. Really, he doesn't. Now, Dovizioso, he's stuck back in sixth. He's not going anywhere. Binder is now caught up to him, and Binder goes by on the KTM. Then we get to the incident of the race. Suddenly, we cut to a shot of Maverick Vinales barrel rolling, into a stop as we look and see his bike go flying into the first turn air fence and explode into a ball of flames. Upon further review of replay, as in what happened to Maverick Vinales, he basically jumped off the bike at 220 kilometers per hour because he did not have any front brakes at all. So he had to make the decision of, like, I need to get off of this. I'm going to take the theoretically safer option of getting off of the bike and sliding on my back and getting a few road rash burns, perhaps, and then while the bike went flying into the air fence. Which, of course, since we have a bike in the air fence is now blown up. We have to go get a new air fence, so we got to red flag the race because it's not safe to continue. By my count, Skyler, I think between the past 2 weekends and all the crash damage from all the bikes, I think we're probably at somewhere between 2.5 and 3 million euros lost over this weekend, these past two weekends.
At the very least, I mean, there has been some serious scrap piles.
Oof, there was. I mean, when they picked up the pieces of Vinales' bike and threw it onto the truck to be transported away, there wasn't a whole lot that was too straight in there. And then, you know, just because Vinales was okay and he was up and he's walking around, we kind of got to talk about a few other little things that we may not be. You know, Vinales has already opened up all five of his Yamaha engines for this year. So if they can't salvage that engine, and I'm fairly certain that given the way the exhaust was crushed back into the front of the engine, I think there's probably a crack in the cases or at least some broken flanges on the cylinder head where the pipes are going to connect, where they may not be able to fix that. I'm not too sure what the rules are, if they could weld it up while it's there or not. I don't know what they can and can't touch in there. I know they were thinking that if they said it was a bad sensor, they could get some discompensation to replace that transmission sensor that was causing them problems earlier on. And so I'm not too sure there. But if not, Vinales is going to have a pit lane start somewhere in all this. So I guess before I turn it back over to you, we kind of had that cutaway. Whereas last weekend, Paul Espargaro was throwing his toys out of the pram because he got stopped. Mir was relatively calm with what was going on, but you did notice he had a sort of a look of dread in his eyes, which we didn't understand at the very beginning as to what was going on. We only found out later that he did not have a new soft front tire to go out on, so he had to go out on the soft tire he had ran for the first 18 laps of the race. Not a good idea. Even Jack Miller, after last week, made sure that he had a brand new tire of every compound that's there just so that he would have everything covered if there was a red flag in the race.
No, and pretty that was definitely thinking. Definitely was a good thing. So that gets us back to the restart. And then Miller and Rins, they didn't have the greatest starts. They fluffed it a little bit. But poor Nakagami, who was running second place at the time, who was very strong, like Mir was getting away, he just ended up getting beat up at the start, dropped back to, I think, about seventh. At this point, Miller, who had a little bit of a start, he regained it after a couple corners, got it figured out, blasted off to the front. But then we noticed right behind him, the KTM crowd has begun. You had Pohl, you had Binder, and you had Oliveira all of there. Pohl ended up getting by Mir for second. Mir was struggling because, like you said, his tire, which we found out had 18 laps on it prior to getting started, was already starting to go. He was starting to look out of it. And at this point, there was a Tech 3 bike that was starting to look a little threatening, and Oliveira, he could hang with them. He was kind of running the same pace. We didn't know if he was dangerous, but he was sticking with it. And with the power that KTM makes, he was definitely going to be sticking around on the straightaways. It was just whether or not he could keep the pace of the guys at the front. Now, the race ended up being, after about for a little while through this, we saw that the race was going to be down between the front three, which was Miller, Pohl, and Oliveira. They were going to be the guys that were going to get it done. With about three to go, you really started to see the punches getting pulled. Pohl got out there, and he got in deep on Miller, started running wide the next turn. Miller pushes Pohl wide, and they kind of just started going back and forth. But as we get to the last lap, it's all on the table. It's all for naught. Pohl and Miller are going back and forth. Once past another corner, go by. Pohl gets by Miller. Miller gets by Pohl. We're headed down to the last corner into turn 10. Pohl or Miller is going to think, like, okay, I've got this. I'm going to run on the inside. I'm going to run them wide. I'm going to take it. Meanwhile, Oliveira is like, if I break early enough, I might just be able to pick up some pieces here if these guys both run wide. Well, guess what? All of a sudden, Miller pushes Pohl wide. He runs wide himself, and Oliveira made the brilliant move of getting on the brakes early, getting on the gas even earlier, shoots by both of them. Two beats him to the finish line to get his first win. Tech 3's first win after 20 years of trying. They get up and cross the line. It is a big, big win for both KTM, who got their second win after having none. They've gotten a win, a pole position, and their junior team has gotten a win, which is still a factory bike. Let's not be ridiculous here. This year, what a year for KTM. KTM is here, ladies and gentlemen. These bikes are for real. Their riders are for real. And if there's one person on that team that is feeling a little down, it might be Pohl Espargaró, because he's watched two other guys get wins on the bike that he delved, and he's going to leave that team to get on a bike that people are kind of not really that sure about. So a great race, a great podium when he gets up there for both. There's two KTMs on the podium, by the way, with one Ducati. That we probably didn't predict this year coming into it. We thought the KTMs were going to get some top fives this year, wins, and the junior team. I didn't see that coming at all, Jim.
No, I think I'm on record as saying that KTM needed a dry podium this year. Well, they surpassed that with two wins another podium. I mean, again, it's the chaos of 2020, right? There's just so much happening. I never in my wildest dreams would have thought that KTM would be as strong as they are right now. I think this is for real. I don't think it's a flash in the pan. I don't think it's, well, these tracks suit what they have. Because, you know, Brno is it's a power track, I will admit. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens when they go to Misano in 2 weeks to see those two races back-to-back to see what the KTMs do. I mean, Binder has been wicked fast there on his Moto2 bike, and I think he's going to be really fast there on the MotoGP bike. As you said, the only guy who doesn't necessarily look that great on a KTM right now is Lecuona. Lecuona's been victimized by crashes, people running into him, and he just doesn't have enough experience. As Simon Crafar said, I asked Oliveira what his plans were for the weekend, and Lecuona says, I just want to finish. You know, he just wants to get some experience on the bike. Oliveira was a very capable guy in Moto2, so for him to win is definitely not out of the cards. You know, I think KTM started in MotoGP in 2015 or 20, maybe 2016. And they said, oh, in 5 years, we're going to be winning races. Hell yeah, they are. I mean, I think everybody thought that was like a bunch of, you know, talking out one side of their mouth and, you know, ha, 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 you don't really understand how complicated this challenge actually is. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know what? I don't think that this is a challenge, but KTM exists to race motorcycles and to win on it, and they have won at every form of motorsport with their bikes that you can think of. I mean, they started out by dominating off-road enduro hair scrambles kind of stuff. They moved into Supercross and built a great team there that's won races here in the U.S. They're basically been unbeaten for almost 14 or 17 years in the Dakar Rally. There was no reason these guys weren't going to figure this out on asphalt too. There's, you know, I think part of their success is they're not afraid to try things, and they're willing to do different things to see what works and what doesn't work. And they've now found some sort of crazy magic where the front end of that V4 is really, really solid. And if a rider has confidence in the front end, they can push. And they can push really hard. And I think that's why you're seeing Oliveira, you're seeing Binder, you're seeing Pohl all be very close to the front running top 10, because the bike is capable of it and so are the riders. So a glorious weekend for KTM all the way around. I feel gutted for Mir. He definitely was on par for a race win. Now going to Misano, a very corner speed friendly track, I really think that Mir and Suzuki and Rinzen too could very well play some spoiler role here going to Misano. I'm interested to see where Yamaha is going to come into all of this, because they need to sort of get themselves together and pick themselves back up after three races on the trot where it's been damage limitation, and damage limitation yet again. So the crazy is still there, and it really, all of this does nothing more than just blow this championship wide open, which is fascinating. If we were to look at the championship standings, Quartararo is on top with 70 points, but Dovizioso is only 3 points behind. And then Miller is there on 56. Binder's there at 49. Vinales is at 48. I mean, that's pretty close.
Yeah, that's real close. That's tight as we've had it in quite a few years, that's for sure.
Sure, this is going down to the wire with probably two or three guys having a chance to win this title at the very end. And, I mean, you know, the other thing is we get to go to Portimão, we get to go to Portugal, and now Portugal has a MotoGP winner, which, how awesome is that? I mean, it's just like destiny in the cards.
Maybe by that time of the year they can have fans.
Well, there was rumor that there were going to be some fans allowed in at Misano. I think it was like 10,000 people or so. So that's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Are you just talking about the Rossi fan club?
Yeah. Shocker. Good one, my friend. Good one. Yes. Yes, the Rossi fan club will be allowed in. That's true.
Yeah.
But, you know, I thought the racing this weekend was fabulous. I mean, every race was a really good race. I mean, you kind of had to wait for the Moto 2 race to get good, but you knew it was coming. And then, man, MotoGP just has been exceeding all of our expectations. I just think every race has gotten better and better and better and better. I don't know how you feel about it, but that's the way I feel.
No, I love the unpredictability, right, of going in every weekend now that the championship is so tight that you can watch every race on pins and needles because every race does matter. It's not so much like it's okay to suck at these three tracks because you know you'll be good at these three and that's when you'll win it. No, that's not the case anymore. You got to be good every weekend. And if you're not, you're going to get left behind real fast. I mean, if you look at the championship, like you were saying, you did the top three, right? You had Quartararo still leading at 70, Dovizioso in 3 points behind. And then Miller takes a stop back, right? He's still another 11 points back on 56. But then it gets real interesting because Brad Binder's in fourth in the championship, but he's on 49 points. He's not a whole lot of points. He's only seven back in Miller, so just a couple positions in a race to make that difference. But then it's Vinales at 48, Nakagami at 46, Rossi at 45, Mir at 44, Oliveira at 43. That means that part of the championship is going to change every single weekend. It just has to because those guys are all interchangeable. So it can even get tighter because the Dovizioso, he has 2 6th place finishes. He's going to fall back. And Miller and Quartararo, who knows, man. So this championship is open. I mean, we can even see Binder win it this year. We can see Rossi win it. We can see Quartararo. Who knows? I have no idea. It's a really fun time to be a fan, especially with the way the season's going to wrap up. Getting the unpredictability of a new track at the season finale. I mean, we could go down to where it could be just 5 points covering the top five, and everybody's got a weekend to A, figure out the track, and then race it. That's going to be insane.
Yeah. There's some tracks coming that I think Binder's really fast at. There's two races at Aragon, and Binder is really quick there, you know. And I think the KTMs will be very quick there. It's suited to them. I think the Yamahas will be won't be as quick because that long straightaway is really going to hurt them. I think Yamaha's best shot to win races is these two races at Misano, and I think also then at Valencia, those two races there. I got to give the nod at Aragon to probably to KTM. As crazy as that sounds, I would probably never be saying that, but in this year, sure, why not? Barcelona, the big long straightaway there, Ducati territory maybe? I don't really know. I mean, Miller rides great everywhere. And then the wild card at the end, that is Portimao. We're going to Le Mans when it's cold, right? Yeah. Well, it's going to be cold. It's also going to be a lot different because there's going to be so much rubber on the track from the 24-hour race, which I think is only like a weekend prior. So there's a curveball on that too. Mm-hmm. I mean, Le Mans is a throw-up. I don't know who's going to do what there. The unpredictability of the championship right now is so great because you legit have four manufacturers. Okay, three. Honda can't win anything right now. But
well, all, Nakagami, maybe. Well,
maybe. I mean, there's a possibility. But, I mean, okay, fine. Let's just go with the four. You've got four manufacturers that have every possibility of winning races. That's crazy.
Yep.
I mean, I cannot think of a time in the premier class that you've had that many manufacturers who could potentially win on a given weekend.
And not in recent history, no.
I was thinking back even to the old days because Agostini would blow everybody off on his MV Agusta, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking the closest you had to maybe parity was three back in the early part of the late part of the 80s or early part of the 90s with a Honda, a Suzuki, and a Yamaha. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's about the last time, and because you either had Schwantz or Doohan or Rainey was going to win a race, but I think these are really golden times that we have right now, and I think as fans we should really enjoy what we're seeing because it is phenomenal racing right now.
Absolutely. Well, Jim, it is an hour and 20 minutes. We need to wrap this up and get out the door. All right, folks, remember, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. That goes to all of the hosts. It'll either wind up on the show or we'll respond directly to you. We can go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/motopod. That's the Motopod fan page. Go ahead and go over there and give us a like. You can also find the shows we post over there as well. We are on Twitter at @moto_pod. You can join us there for some general news and some motorcycle banter, yada, yada. I can be found on Twitter and Instagram, although I'm not super active on social media at the moment. But that's where you can find me if you ever want to ask me questions, yada, yada. And then I'm located there at SkylarV28. Jim, where can people find you?
At MotoRGV, Twitter and Instagram.
Woo! All right, so another long show. We get to take a little bit of a break now, even for us, which is good because me and Jim have been busy. It's been busy times, and I think we need a break, dude.
I agree.
So, all right, folks, we will be seeing you when racing resumes back at Misano. We'll jump back in. But until then, stay safe, wash your hands, and, with all the turmoil and everything on, just, try to respect one another. Let's just leave it at that.